This week on Red Dead Radio, we're surprisingly mellow.
I'm not gonna lie, I'm a little scared. Are you okay?
Hi, friends. Welcome to Red Dead Radio, the Red Dead Redemption podcast. I'm your host, Jared Petty. There we are. A little bit. Well, I'm kind of keeping it down a little here. Keep it a little chill.
You gotta keep it up. Gotta keep it down. I got you.
We're going straight to the wild guest. We're going straight to the wild guest. Yeah.
Okay. I got you. And be honest with you, John Ryan. Been on the road a lot lately, so have you.
Oh my God, I'm so tired.
You've been all over the place.
I'm so tired, Jared. What am I gonna do?
And by the way, who are you?
Oh, I'm John Ryan. Hi, hello. Yes,
that's right.
You may know me from such podcasts as Red Dead Radio, the Red Dead Redemption podcast.
And also from Ye Old.
Ye Old IGN, yes. Indeed. That's also true.
That's a place where you work and make content.
It is, yeah. I work on our guides team, so it is currently September something. and that means we're about to fall full swing into the guides creation season, which means my brain is about to become a nice, hearty puddle of mush.
Yeah, it is that time when the early releases kind of come in. You get the hands on and start getting those guides ready for people so they can play their fun games in October.
Spider-Man for PlayStation, Marvel Spider-Man. It's just a little game. It's very independent. You probably haven't heard of it.
Yeah.
We also have another very small independent game called Shadow of the Tomb Raider coming out this week.
Oh, no.
Actually going into early access today.
Just a quaint little ditty, that
one. Just a quaint little ditty. It's also actually really good. You should check it out. But this is not a Spider-Man, nor is it a Tomb Raider podcast.
No, indeed. This is Red Dead Radio, the Red Dead Redemption podcast.
You say it so much better than me.
Well, I've said it a lot.
Yeah, I should have said it a lot, too.
You should do the intro next week.
No, I'm not doing that.
I think it'd be fantastic. You'd be very good at it. You have a good radio voice, better than mine.
Okay, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
I sound like Vizzini when I talk on the radio. But, ladies and gentlemen, we're here to talk about the Old West, and we got a lot to talk about because, the reason I mentioned being tired earlier, John and I both been on the road a lot. John, you just got back from Gamescom, then straight to PAX. I was at
PAX.
That
was a goof.
Then down at Crunchyroll Expo, where I was doing a Dragon Quest panel.
Oh, God, you did do that, didn't you?
Yeah, I went down there and did that.
Good
so
Lord,
we've been traveling a lot. But, we just got back from PAX where we did Red Dead Radio Live.
We did. It was super fun.
It was super fun. If you haven't listened to it yet, if you haven't watched it yet, I encourage you to. What's Good Games, Brittany Baumbacher, Christine Steimer, they're with us. We talked about Gun, finally.
We did. We finally talked about Gun and the original Red Dead, and most importantly, dying of dysentery on the Oregon Trail.
Indeed. I'm very excited about that. Actually,
no, I changed my pronunciation after last time.
Oh, no kidding.
I guess I got visually
corrected.
Slapped in the face.
You did. You got some looks there. Also, you learned what squatting was on that panel. Christine demonstrated.
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. That's true.
I think you already knew what squatting
was.
Well,
no. She corrected me because I had mistakenly learned that it was deadlifting.
Ah.
Because it's a fun time.
We were talking about how Arthur was strong. Anyway, we had a lot of fun.
He's a strong
panel.
Man.
I want to thank everyone that came to that panel. There was a ridiculous amount of encouragement there. Thank you. One dude was dressed as a cowboy. Patreon producer Tom Bach was there. That was pretty awesome.
Great. It was super fun to meet Tom.
Speaking of Patreon producer Tom Bach, I want to thank Patreon producer Tom Bach, Stuart Ferguson, and Jonathan for making the show possible. Because without them, there would be no show. And if you want to back us on Patreon, you can do so. We do this for a living, so it's really, really helpful. I do this for a living. I don't know why you're here. But
you know I have nowhere else to go. For a second, when you said, speaking of Patreon producer Tom Bach, I got really worried because the way that you said it made me think that there was some kind of terrible news coming.
Oh, no, Tom Bach's the best.
So I'm glad you're okay.
No, we got to meet Tom and his daughter.
Yep, they were very, very sweet. Asked some super fun questions.
Had a really good time there. But we have news. That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, the Red Dead news season has become, we are standing a bare month out from Red Dead Redemption's release. We have somehow managed to talk for 18 episodes previous to this about this upcoming show. Well, they have run a really smart campaign. They have given us just
enough. Oh, yeah, they're super good at the slow
drip. To keep looking for, they really are. But now it's that time of the season for love.
Yes, because we've got, 6 weeks left until
launch?
Yeah,
just over a month out.
God.
It's freaking amazing. So, last week, just after we recorded the last episode and got it posted, Rockstar dropped a bunch of information about Dutch Van Der Linde's game.
Oh my God, there's so many people. We already know a tremendous amount about several of these characters.
Yeah, and those are the ones we're not going to go over here. But
we've got a nice page here. Top Jared went ahead because he's super studious and very organized and printed out All the images for us with all these
anybody can cut and paste. But what I want to talk about here, so Rockstar actually released these 25 portraits, 25 quotes. I love how they did this. They showed a portrait, a quote, and then a one-sentence bio.
Yeah.
And the way I wanted to approach this tonight, because I think this has already been talked over quite a lot this week, I wanted to take a little bit of a different take on it. I wanted to focus on the quote. I wanted to take that picture and the quote and take what we can draw from about each person just from that quote, because that's a really clever marketing approach. It's very hard, in my opinion, to be disciplined in marketing. It is always easier to say more than less when you're trying to sell something.
That's very fair. I think it's interesting, too, because when you look at it at the sort of history of what we've seen of both the press previews, but also especially from the trailers, they're really trying to get us to understand that this gang is not just like a mechanical function of the game, that it is a group of people who you are going to be spending, you know, the lion's share of your time in this game with. And the thing about this is, like, this is essentially, this image and this quote is basically your first impression of these characters.
Of each of these people.
If you're at a party, you've just met 25 people who have each walked up to you, shaken your hand, and said one thing at you.
And this is so smart because it gives you an idea of the scope. It helps you understand this is a large group of people. But beyond the scope, that they're an interrelated group of people, that this is a community, that this is a big part of the game.
And, like, I've run into a few of these people both in the preview that I was fortunate enough to partake in earlier in the spring. Also, we've all run into some of them in the trailers. You know, there's Lenny and Micah and Sadie. But there are some folks who we straight up just have never really known more about aside from they were in a couple of big group shots.
Yeah.
And I am super intrigued to know more about them.
And so they give us this quote, and they let us fill in the gaps with our brains. They don't tell us too much. And I like that. And that leads to fun, speculative games. So what John and I are going to do, we're just going to go through all these characters and talk about them. I would love to hear your predictions about these characters, which you can send a mail at reddedredemption.com. That's mail. No, not reddedredemption.com. Don't send it there. Mail.
I mean, send it there. You could. But then also CC us.
Yeah. Mail at reddedradio.com. That's mail at reddedradio.com. Send us that. Let's talk about these guys. First off, Arthur Morgan.
I don't know anything about this guy. Who the fuck?
Who's Arthur Morgan? None of us know.
I literally wrote an article called that.
What? Who is Arthur Morgan?
That was actually a title of a
book. So we're not going to linger on Arthur.
So we know who Arthur
is. We have talked about Arthur. We're thieves in a world that don't want us no more.
So here's the thing. Like, we're not going to talk a whole lot about Arthur, but I actually really love that quote for a lot of reasons. I have a really particular passion for the structure of written sentences based on how they're said.
Yeah.
Like, I really love, like, sort of grammatical colloquialisms. That notion of, like, they don't want us no more. Like, grammatically, that is a nightmare of a sentence. But I really love the way that it rings in your ear. And I really appreciate when people just write it down correctly.
Yeah. Well, it says something about the man. It says that here's a human being that's articulate in thought, but not necessarily educated.
And I think that they do an exceptional, exceptional job of that with the rest of these as well.
Yeah, they're good at that. I think good dialogue writers. But we're not going to talk Arthur to death. But before we move on, there is one thing I want to note. I have no idea if this means anything. It's just something I noticed. Most of these characters, 23 of the 25, holding something. And the ones that aren't seem to have something that stands out prominently.
Yeah.
I just want to point that out. It could just be Ricky Bobby. I don't know what to do with my hands. It's more interesting to have somebody holding something in an image, you know.
But I think it gives you sort of an idea, you know, as with anybody, like with first impressions, like if you first notice someone from across a room, you see how they're standing. You see if they're holding anything. Like your first impression of me would be wildly different if I was holding, you know, a bouquet of flowers or a martini glass as opposed to a mug full of beer.
A mug full of beer.
Like, you're...
My impression would be that you're a more discerning drinker than you are on regular episodes.
I like what we call in the business, swill.
Ah, okay. I like the idea of you just standing there with a bouquet of flowers wherever you go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I look, here's the deal.
You're a fancy fellow.
I absolutely love a bouquet of flowers or bouquet. A bouquet. You like to pronounce
if you want to mail us flowers, we'll take them.
I'll absolutely take flowers. We'll I've like happily flowers. Received flowers to my desk at IGN.com before.
By the way, again, because I love to interject, we're in the middle of topics. But for those of you that sent things for the studio, I don't think I've addressed this yet, and I should. Thank you. The studio is almost done. We will be in there very soon, and your things will be hanging and pointed out properly and appreciated then.
You guys sent in flowers?
Please don't think that that I don't appreciate these things and we're not going to use them. We are very, very soon. I'm not going to say this is the last episode we're filming in here, but it might be, at least for a while.
I refuse to go. You know I live here.
Yeah, that's true.
Not fair.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
No, I think that's... I didn't know that. That's incredibly sweet of all y'all. Yep. Thank you muchly and kindly.
Okay, so this guy, Arthur, anyway, he's holding... He's just sawed off double-barrel shotgun. He's some guy, and he's our main character, and we know about that. We've talked about Arthur. If you want to know more about Arthur, please listen to the first 18 episodes of Red Dead Radio, the Red Dead Redemption podcast.
Right. I mean, I feel like...
I think it's just an F-solve. F-solve. I tripped on my route. It's like, it's I did okay. say episodes. It's like okay. episodes.
I legitimately think we probably have talked about the potential depth of Arthur's character for at least 11 or 12 of those 18 episodes.
All right.
By which I mean the 11 or 12 episodes that I've been on.
Number two, Sadie Adler. What's the quote, John?
Nobody's taken nothing from me ever again.
And once again, the colloquialism to the...
I mean, again, like they do that really well throughout all of these. There are a bunch. Like I think all of these are a... some version of like a colloquial idiom where it's very indicative of who this person is, where this person is from. Like we'll get to it in a minute, but one of my favorite in this bunch is Sean McGuire's, because as an Irishman, I really appreciate it. We'll get to that later.
So Sadie, nobody's taken nothing from me ever again. What's been taken from Sadie, you think?
Oh, probably lots.
Yeah. Being a Western, we have that tradition of Josie Wales-dom. We have that tradition of revenge. We have the tradition of being hurt.
There's always the notion of loss whenever a protagonist's type character or a supporting character who is on your side is an outlaw. You know, I mean, obviously this is a whole gang of outlaws. You know, the concept of outlaws to the end is constantly ringing throughout all of Red Dead. And, you know, Sadie is very much, you know, I feel emblematic of that. We've seen her in the trailers be very, I'll say, action-oriented.
Yeah.
Stabbing someone cleanly through the hand.
Oh, I mean, we see her right here. She's wielding dual pistols.
Right.
I mean,
so that's the thing, you know, about Sadie, we know a few things. A, she is very fiercely capable of protecting herself.
Yeah.
And both from this quote, the art style, and what we've seen of her already, we know damn well that she is not someone to be trifled with.
So what, that sense of protectiveness, I assume we're going to find out about the background there on her and where that comes from. But if
yes.
you, so before we move on talking here about the band, what this keeps reminding me of more than anything else is almost a Robin Hood style inspiration. I'd love to talk with the writing staff at some point and find out how much Howard Pyle they
Rockstar,
went into on this.
Rockstar, if you do happen to have any fingers in the pie of watching this, that sounded super weird and I'm sorry I said it like that. Yeah, send us your writer, not like in a box or anything.
No, well, I mean, he could be in a box
I would be super intrigued to speak with the writing staff about it.
But I'd like to know, yeah, because, I mean, we know Robin Hood and his merry men. We know those people that go off and form a sort of an outlaw society.
Well, you know, I mean,
I wonder where the inspirations
are. We've known from day one that Dutch is banned. And, you know, Dutch, I think, is the very last person on the list of all these folks. But, like, Dutch is banned is not... It's definitely not a one-to-one of Robin Hood, but there is that sort of, it's like the twisted fairy tale version of that. It's this very strange take on what we know of the, what I'll call the lovable rogues.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certainly people in this group who are most certainly not lovable, Dutch being chief among them.
Yeah.
He's a real piece of
and
shit.
And yet they all love boy. Dutch, it seems.
But he's enigmatic enough, he's got plans, they've all got, the drive to make a better life for themselves. So necessarily, I don't think it's, you know, steal from the rich, give to the poor. It's more steal from the rich because the rich don't deserve what they have.
Yeah, I think
and
that's
we
more
deserve a better life.
Well, and this was a period of time. I mean, this is the age of the robber baron
in
America. This is a time when rich people, I mean, not particularly difficult from today, or different from today in a lot of ways.
Well,
but
I
this
mean,
was, it, this was a time when there was even less protection of the American ordinary person than there is now.
Yep, absolutely.
And people were taking advantage of that system and using vast wealth to wield tremendous control,
of course,
political power over people's
lives. I mean,
one of
the best tropes of all Western media, whether it's movies, games, TV, comics, is, you know, the corrupt governor of whatever territory you happen to be in, where it's, you know, even in ridiculous comedies like Blazing Saddles, like one of the most ludicrous Westerns ever made, but also one of the most traditional in a lot of ways.
I grew up near Biltmore in Western North Carolina. Biltmore is effectively a castle built by George Vanderbilt, who was a railroad baron, a robber baron. But a guy literally just built himself a castle in the hills in Western North Carolina. And was like, here I shall dwell on my manor lands.
You know, I literally can do that.
It would be very easy to look at a world where that was happening while people were starving. And
I can't see any parallels between then and now.
Never.
Not at all.
Number three, Sean McGuire.
Sean McGuire. So
Sean's quote?
Sean's quote is, just leave it to me. I can talk a dog off a meat wagon.
Is that Sean's voice? You've seen him in the...
Yeah, Sean is as stereotypically Irish as you could possibly get.
Even more Irish than Irish? I mean, I think of the character Irish.
Yeah, no, I know. 6 1/2 dozen of another.
Okay, I wonder. Because I had forgotten just how blindingly stereotypical
blindingly Irish
yeah,
is.
I mean, his name is Irish.
The context that I know Sean from is during the demo that I watched, he was telling this story about when he first met Dutch and his band. They'd essentially gotten him drunk enough to not realize that they'd stolen the bullets from his gun.
Okay.
So, you know, whether or not Sean's actual character turns out to be like the almost cartoonish rendition of an Irishman in
I certainly
the
hope not. I
feel like there is a place for that, but I don't necessarily know if that's going to be a chief member of the gang.
I don't see them leaning in on that. I feel like they want you to care about these people. There's going
exactly.
to be a layer
and that's
of
the whole
surface.
Thing. And, but like, I mean, this is the thing where it's like, to me, Sean is, you know, I know virtually nothing about him aside from the sort of attitude that he espouses. But this quote specifically makes me care about him because it rings very, very true. If you can't tell from the fact that my name is John Ryan, I'm very
John
Irish.
Patrick Ryan.
Your
name is John Patrick Ryan.
My name is John Patrick Ryan. Technically Jonathan, but I super don't like that. But were my mother to have kept her maiden name, I would be John Patrick O'Brien Ryan. Why I love Sean and why he resonates with me is because this is essentially a parable for something that I grew up my entire life hearing from one member of my family or another.
Okay.
And that is, what the hell is it? Irish diplomacy. It's the art of telling someone to go to hell in a way that they're looking forward to making the trip.
Huh. I've never heard that phrase before.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. All the fucking times.
Was that something you heard in Boston? Or in
I grew up in Massachusetts. It's a very Irish... What the hell is the proper
I don't know.
Irish there? Anyway, a very Irish-centric community.
I've never heard the term Irish diplomacy, but when I read this quote, the first place my mind went is Face from the A-Team.
Yeah, 100%. That's the thing. Like, if it was a D&D party, they'd be your bard.
Hmm.
I mean, this is what, to me, the charismatic face of an operation would look like.
I still like the fact that you and John Ryan have the same name from Tom Clancy novels. I think that's amazing.
Oh yeah, well I do. I considered going by Jack in high school, but I already have an Uncle Jack, so it'd have been a whole weird thing.
Yeah, but he's John Patrick Ryan.
That's the weirdest part for me because like I didn't know he was John Patrick Ryan until the middle. Jack Ryan between now and the last.
Well, let's see. There's Affleck Ryan.
No, no, no.
Baldwin Ryan.
No. Not starting from the past. I mean, starting from here, from John Krasinski working backwards. It was the one before John.
There's
Krasinski.
Harrison Ford Ryan. There's
no.
Affleck Ryan.
No, it's not. It's not the movie. It's the most recent movie Ryan.
I don't know anymore.
Is it Chris Pine?
There've been a lot of Ryans.
I think it's Chris Pine. Was the latest Jack?
Sure, let's say it's Chris Pine. It's one of the Chris's. Hemsworth.
John,
could
Jack
be
Ryan's Shadow Recruit.
Liam Hemsworth.
Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit. That's the movie that I'm thinking of.
All right,
that movie literally starts. My name is John Patrick Ryan. I'm just like,
well, so is mine.
I don't like that. That throws me for a fucking
Gwyneth
loop.
Paltrow. That was the last Jack Ryan. Gwyneth Paltrow.
What?
That's who it was.
I would. Here's the deal. I know you're joking. I would love to see that.
That would be awesome.
I would 100% watch a gender bent Jack Ryan. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Anyways.
Reverend Swanson. What's this quote, John?
I had real suffering and I lost everything. My vocation, my faith, and my family.
Okay, so here we have it. So
here's a character that we've never seen before.
Never before. Yeah.
We may have seen him in the background of a couple of shots from trailers, but we know virtually nothing about him.
Sean was carrying a shotgun in a combat position. This guy holding the glass. Looks drunk.
Looks like a flask to me.
Yeah, is it a flask or a glass?
I believe it's a glass flask.
Or a bottle. Well into a bender, it looks like. This is not coffee, this man's drinking.
I don't think I would say bender on that one. I would say constant state of mind.
First off, as you pointed out earlier before the show, he looks like Ron Swanson.
A little bit.
Okay.
He's got a little bit of that sort. The mustache does not do any favors against that.
And his name is Reverend Swanson. Which is kind of awesome.
R. Swanson is definitely, there's a comparison to be made there. I don't think that's like a rock star Easter egg.
I don't either, but
it's a comparison that I happen to like because I really like Ron Swanson a lot.
This guy, we haven't seen him before. This appeals to me especially because
of your history.
Because of my history. Yeah. I am an ordained minister.
I mean, technically I am too.
That's a good point. But yeah, I pastored a church.
You're actually you didn't just do it on the internet.
No, I've baptized people. I've delivered sermons. Yes. I have preached several hundred times in front of groups of people.
Preacher.
Yeah. And the idea of somebody, so I left that vocation. Right. I didn't leave it for dark and sinister reasons.
Of course not.
But I did leave it, and it does fundamentally affect you.
Yeah.
This person saying, I lost everything. I lost my vocation. Well, that's true. Once you're a minister and you're not a minister anymore, it's weird. Mm-hmm. It just is. And that's a longer topic than I think we have time for here. But the fact that vocation's the first word, that's thoughtful writing. That's somebody that understands how a job that's not just a job.
A vocation is something that is very, 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 very fundamentally tied to who you are as a person.
Yeah, there's a reason that I do little podcasts about how we should all get along and things can be better, and it's because I may have left the job, but I never quite left the vocation.
Yep.
Then he says, my faith. Okay, so the minister that's lost his faith. This is one of the great storytelling archetypes regardless of the religion.
Yep.
Doesn't matter if it's Christianity, doesn't matter if it's Judaism, doesn't matter if it's Islam, doesn't matter if it's Hinduism.
Yeah, faithless preacher is one of the most tried and true, and also one of my personally favorite archetypes.
Right. And then finally, the family. We don't know about that.
Well, I feel like this tells us one of two things. Either Reverend Swanson has suffered an impossible tragedy, or he has made an incredibly horrific mistake. Mm-hmm. One of those two things I feel is happening.
Or see all of the above.
Or all of the above, yes. Or he made a horrendous mistake that resulted in an impossible tragedy,
mm-hmm.
Which is entirely possible knowing sort of the rough world of the late 1800s.
So this minister fallen from grace is here traveling with a band of outlaws. And when we say band, again, we talked about outlaws earlier, but this isn't six or seven folks living. This is a community.
Right. It is a right and proper almost town.
Yeah, this is Suikoden. This is Suikoden 2. This is stronghold. What is it? Stronghold from Dragon Quest Inquisition. You know, this is your family. Okay. This is your group of people that you go back to between things.
Exactly. This is your home.
And I'm excited. This is your home. The people are your home.
And so, I mean, that's kind of the thing that a lot of games don't do these days. Mm-hmm. That I'm really excited to see how it's handled in Red Dead 2.
Yeah.
You know, we've got fucking pages, so I don't want to go on forever, but...
No, it's okay.
This notion of, you know, because, I mean, I very much, I was born in Winchester, Mass. I grew up on an island off the coast of Massachusetts. I lived in Boston for many years. I lived in L.A. for many years. I now live in San Francisco. I consider many places to be my home because of the people who I know and love there.
Yeah.
It's not about where I'm necessarily born. It's not necessarily where I have lived the longest. I mean, granted, you know, now home is a very specific thing because of where I have built my life.
Well, the army definition of home changes over time.
Exactly. I would not say that my home is a place. It's my home is the people who I care most about and who I know care most for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much what this is. And I don't feel games have done that super well.
No, not often.
It's hard to do well.
I mentioned Suikoden 2 earlier, which is my favorite example of it. Yeah, it's okay.
I'm a heathen?
No, I Suikoden is one of those games that I slept on when it was new, and then...
When did that come out?
That's a PlayStation-era game, and it made
them...
Definitely
missed that one.
And it's a wonderful Konami RPG.
Okay, great,
that was done
before they were Konami of today.
Yeah, before they were Konami of today. And the second installment in that series is up there in the Chrono Trigger level of great RPGs.
All right,
it's one of the all-time greats. Incredible music, incredible combat system, incredible story, but what... Several things make Suikoden 2 stand out.
Okay.
First, it's very much like Red Dead, as we've heard it described, in that it is a story where you are a player in a larger world.
Great. Love those.
It's not about you changing the universe. It's about you being part of where you are.
Right.
Unlike most RPGs, there's not some world-threatening enemy that's out to destroy everything.
You just exist.
No, you're just in the middle of a very localized, morally ambiguous conflict. Mm. With people you love who are on different sides, and you're just trying to be the best person you can in a very difficult situation.
Hmm. I'm into it.
Yeah, it's second.
I will never play that game, but I'm into the concept.
Yeah, second, you assemble a group of friends that gradually grow into a community and then literally become a town.
Great.
108 allies
you
recruit over time. Yeah, not all of whom are combat allies. Well, some of them are just like, hello, I'm the town baker. But
Look, somebody's going to make that bread.
And that's the idea. You go back to that town and there's always something going on. And I feel like, and there's always, and it's not just like, oh, here's a distraction. You care about what's happening there and how what you're doing is affecting it.
Exactly.
I feel like that's what's going to go on with the game.
I mean, and you know, as we look through the rest of these pages, like, I'm really curious to know how those people operate and, like, who those people are who aren't necessarily just combat friends or who aren't necessarily just the camp's cook. Like, you know, we've known Pearson, who is in a few pages from now, is the camp's cook. He's... There's a bunch that we know of him from what we've seen and what we've experienced in both in these... updates in the trailers, in our demos, but there's other people like this dude.
Yep, let's move on.
Josiah Trelawney.
Josiah Trelawney.
So, looks a little bit like a magician, which I'm super into.
Wearing gloves, holding his hat.
If again, holding this top hat. D&D analogy, he'd be our sorcerer, 100%, which I'm super into because top hat, mustache, gloves.
Okay,
I'm into it. Sorcerer's origins. I want to hear about him.
And
he's a fucking hopeless romantic, which I love.
Yeah, what's the quote?
How can romance ever be silly? It's all we have.
Okay, hopeless romantic.
This dude, I like him a lot.
Yeah?
But that's very much how I feel about the concept of love, relationships, sex in certain ways. But, like, the concept of romance or love is super important. Because he's right in legitimately saying, like, that's honestly all there really is in this whole thing that we're doing here.
Human relationships and affection for one another.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, you can have animosity towards people, but really you're just wasting your time doing that.
Why would you want to do that?
Not to.
Exactly.
And it's... Yeah, I know literally nothing about this man aside from he is impeccably well-dressed.
He is very well-dressed. He's wearing gloves. He doesn't quite... But he doesn't, like, have a particularly... I don't know. I can't tell if he's a gentleman, a gambler.
Like a little concerned by him,
yeah,
because he kind of looks like the stranger from Red Dead 1, the basically Satan.
Oh, interesting.
Or you know, the Reaper, or whoever you want to call him. I don't think that they're one and the same person, obviously, but I do get that sense of, like, a man doesn't wear gloves all the time.
Maybe it's a devil may care. Well, we don't know if he's wearing them all the time. He could just have them for this.
My assumption is, if you see them wearing this particular outfit at their introduction, you'll see them wearing this outfit a lot.
Hey, I think it's to tell us something about the character, definitely.
Yes.
I mean.
So, a man who wears gloves by choice, consistently, we know that they live in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
There's something nefarious about that.
What about that?
My suspicions may be misplaced. That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's a reason he wears those gloves. Now, maybe it's like a V for Vendetta situation where he really burned his hand super really horribly bad, and so he wants to cover up his hideous disfigurement because it impedes his romance.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So why is this romantic in a group of outlaws? And I want to use that term outlaws instead of criminals or even gang members. Outlaw is a word that its origins
it
have.
Is someone who exists beyond the realm.
Exists outside the realm of the law,
yeah.
Right? And not necessarily nefarious at all, but certainly a social outcast. And the West historically, we haven't talked about this a tremendous amount, is a place where social outcasts very often did find life after life.
Of
you
course.
And I go into a place in our lives where certain things happen. We may never recover in this civilized world.
Mm-hmm.
But when there was a West,
there was always some place to go.
It was rough.
You
it was dangerous. It was lethal.
But it wasn't the hell of your own making that you may have necessarily come from.
Exactly. A world would not necessarily follow you there for a while.
It's funny to me because I feel like there are a couple of potential explanations for this. I feel like we know, based on the other people that we've seen in this gang, Bill Williamson, Dutch, you know, Javier Escuela, even John to an extent, because we know he did really terrible things. We know that there are inherently bad people in this gang. Yeah. There are, when you have that band of outlaws, sure, maybe some of them are outlaws in only the definition of the word and the fact that they exist outside the law. But there's also the other type of folks that that attracts. Mm-hmm. So potentially that may be what we're looking with. We're looking at in the case of Mr. Trelawney.
People here that maybe don't feel like they have anywhere else to go, but
not
this counterculture.
Not necessarily that they have anywhere else to go or in part of counterculture. Like, I mean, there's 100% there is the chance that Mr. Trelawney here basically just got the equivalent of the Scarlet Letter from his hometown and had to go.
Okay.
You know, maybe he was into some proclivities that the rest of town may not have super been okay with.
Well, who doesn't love a good proclivity?
That's very fair. But there's also the entirely potential possibility that he's not a super good dude. Maybe he uses those gloves to strangle people.
Well, I mean, there's the other end to think about with this. A lot of these people are holding guns in these pictures.
And he's not.
And he's not. But
that's
because
he kills motherfuckers with his hands.
Well, that's it. Even if he's not holding a gun, though, these are people that are living their lives by the gun.
So,
and ultimately, that does. I mean, yes, I understand authority also has guns.
Yes,
but
here's why the romance quote for me could be a double-edged sword. Okay. I love the idea of him essentially being almost a poet, mm-hmm. like this hopeless romantic who has, for whatever reasons, ended up with this band of outlaws. But there's also the sort of more nefarious meaning of that, where someone uses this sort of idealized version of romance to cover up atrocious behavior, mm-hmm. which is something that we see very much today. It's something that we know was definitely a tool of the wicked back in those days.
Yeah, I've read Silence of the Lambs. I mean, and I think about, I don't remember who made the quote, but somebody said about Hannibal Lecter once, I think it was on VH1's I Love the 80s of all things.
Was it Hal Sparks?
No, it wasn't. But she said...
John Leguizamo.
She said, if...
Henry Winkler.
If you met him at a party, you would want him to like you.
Yeah.
And there's
and so that's the thing where it's like, I feel like Trelawney could be this very genuine, mm-hmm. very self-effacing, you know, romantic individual, or he's a fucking monster. Mm. And I'm super curious. Like, here's the thing. Both of those are interesting character options to me.
And there could also be secret option three that they're all there together, because characters in Rockstar Games do tend to have that kind of, even the most virtuous characters in Rockstar Games usually have a kind of a shadowy nuance to them.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the one thing that they really love to do is create these sort of moral ambiguities. Mm-hmm. Like, it could be both. He could be a completely virtuous romantic poet who has also committed atrocities in the past.
Yeah,
like
lots of people. Lenny Summers,
Lenny Leonard,
living free out here like this. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yep.
Okay. Lot to unpack here. So first off, holding what looks like either a Henry or Winchester rifle. I think a Winchester from the length of the barrel, but I'm not
going
to
go ahead and
sure.
guess you're right on that assumption. But then again, I also don't know guns super well.
Looking at the weapon, well, by 1899, you wouldn't see a lot of Henrys anyway, and that's a carbine length weapon, so that's probably a Winchester. Suspenders, but this is our first non-white dude.
Yep.
So far on the list here. First person we haven't seen that's not a white dude or lady here.
Yeah, who is a person of color. I think the quote could be something that is taken a little too on the nose by mm-hmm. some, especially given the time period. It's only 30 years or so after the end of the Civil War.
Yeah, it'd be 34 years after the end of the Civil War.
What I like about Lenny, and I've mentioned this before, Lenny is a character who, in the demo that we saw, clearly is all about this notion of freedom for, not just for everybody, but also fairness for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, in the demo that we saw, he was one of the first people to sort of jump to Bill Williamson's defense when everyone was kind of shitting on him. Rightly so, Bill's a fucking idiot. But he made the point that there was this sort of double standard between the leadership of the gang, Dutch, Bill, Dutch, Arthur, and the rest, and sort of the rank and file guns for hire, like Bill, who may not be the smartest guys on earth, but they're there, they're doing their fair share as best they can. And Lenny was really a proponent of making sure that the little people were, or little-minded people were spoken for.
Yeah.
No matter
that everybody was getting equal treatment.
Exactly.
Even if their actions were not necessarily being the warmest or best for everybody around them, they were still being addressed fairly. Yeah.
So, you know, as I've said many times, I like Lenny a lot. It's going to be really hard for me to not call him Lenny Leonard.
Why is that?
Because anytime I find anyone named Lenny, I just automatically want to call them Lenny Leonard or Carl Carlson.
Okay. I have nothing to say about that whatsoever.
All right. That's fair.
But yeah, and I wonder, I don't know about the on the noses. I suspect, again, we are going to find more nuance to that. Because if you're in an outlaw gang, freedom's going to be of utmost concern in so many different dimensions.
Accurate.
You know, when you're a person that's literally under the knife, under the noose, or going to be locked up, freedom's important. But when I was in Japan, one of the things I learned about law that I didn't understand before living there was that in our society and in Japanese society, and I suspect in most societies, mm-hmm. there's a tremendous difference between social law and legislative law. And I didn't realize how powerful social law is. In Japan, a lot of things are completely legal that most people would never, ever consider doing.
Like what?
Because of the social consequences of what that would mean. For example, things they might commit in the workplace. If they're subjected to something that's considered a socially acceptable behavior that we might regard as abusive, it may be illegal to subject that person to that, but they are very likely to take it because of the social stigma of standing up against it. Well, you saw Agresico, right?
I did, yes. I feel like I know exactly what you're talking about, but I'm mm-hmm. not going to be not bummed out by it.
And I'm not going to be not bummed out by it. And if we were just talking about Japanese society here, that'd be one thing.
But that's a whole other podcast. You can catch that later.
No, what I mean is that very, very, very similar things happen in our culture.
Yes, yes,
and
they
in
do.
Many, many cultures.
In different, both for better and for much, 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 much worse in some cases, in very different ways.
Yeah. And so I think about freedom. I imagine Rockstar is going to explore social and legal dimensions of freedom.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, that's sort of the thing is, like, you know, Rockstar does not shy away from diving into, you know, social commentary.
No, they kind of leap into that, actually. And Red Dead's never had it doesn't have the on-the-noseness that GTA has. They're very different in character than that, but they're still going to engage it.
I appreciate what the sort of, you know, social commentary and the comedy that they put in that front, and even some of the times when they take it seriously in the Grand Theft Auto universe, but I really like what they do with it in the Red Dead world. You know, in the original Red Dead Redemption, you have Nigel West Dickens, who is this complete charlatan, an absolute, you know, literally a snake oil salesman.
Yeah.
But he's someone who, the way that he operates and the way that you interact with him easily represents, you know, the businessman of the modern age.
Yeah.
The same thing with politicians and the governmental employees, like representing the government of today. The social commentary in the Red Dead universe, to me, is far more preferable because it's far more interesting to see how one draws the parallels between that age and today.
I think almost it would be fair to say that one is parody and the other satire. And there are distinct differences between parody and satire.
They're super.
I feel like that Red Dead is satire and that GTA is more parody.
Yeah. It's the difference between Mel Brooks and Monty Python.
Very good. I like that.
You know, I love them both for different reasons. Mm-hmm. But something about Mel Brooks with a paddleball is a little bit less serious than, you know, the Life of Brian as a whole.
Well, let's play chess.
Anyways. Mary Beth Gaskell.
Mary Beth Gaskell, indeed. Gentlemen, I think I've got something good. Now, Mary Beth has won my heart because she's holding a book.
Okay.
Not holding a gun, not holding a hat. Mary Beth's holding a book. An open book to her chest there. What's that book? I don't know, but she's reading.
I'm going to get really close to it and see if I can tell.
I occasionally, quote unquote, deer hunt when I go to my in-laws in Kentucky.
And when you say quote unquote, do you mean you actually go hunting for deer, or you go and
I get up early in the morning. I'm staying with my in-laws.
Oh, you go hunting, but you don't kill anything.
I load my rifle. Mm-hmm. I have a fairly decent deer rifle I keep out there. I go out to the woods early in the morning. I climb into the deer stand. Mm-hmm. And I sit and watch the sun come up. And I read Poe. Or Thomas More.
That's actually an impossibly adorable mental image.
And I do that. Really great. I do that until the sun comes up.
I can hear a harmonica in the background. It's all very sweet.
And then I come down from the stand, go back to my in-laws, like, no, didn't see any. Didn't get any today.
Yeah. That's how I am when I go fishing.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll go to the beach. I'll set up a rod. I won't really put any bait on the hook. I'll sort of half-acidly cast it out to sea, and I'll just sit on the beach and just, you know, watch the waves for an hour or two.
And again, we could have gone with a bio here on Mary Beth, but I like her book, and I like that she's got something good. Is she the planner? Is she the scout? Is she... What do you think?
I feel like, based on just these factors, what we see, I feel like she's sort of the... if we're looking at, like, a modern heist allegory, she's the hacker.
I'm a hacker.
I'm in...
I prefer to be called a hacker.
No. It's a Unix system.
I know this. Okay, you know what? When you look at that 3D environment she's flying through, to be fair, the file structure that's over every one of those little icons is, in fact, a Unix directory. So they're not entirely off.
Look, here's the deal. They get it, but why?
No, why would they use a 3D directory system? Exactly.
Because it's the future, Jared.
Well, yeah, but in the novel, it's just like text. Because if you're running something on Unix or FreeBSD or Linux or Berkeley BSD or any of the rest of them.
Look, fucking Sam L. Jackson was using MS-DOS 3.1 to fucking hack out Dennis Nedry. And all of a sudden, GIFs showed up.
No, wait, was it DOS? I thought he was still there in Linux. Oh, wait, no, because Nedry's working on a Mac.
That's what I'm saying.
The idea that there's some like 80s hack or 90s hacker.
This is not a Jurassic Park podcast. That is going to be another show that we do in its entirety. You didn't say the magic word. You didn't say the magic word. Please, God damn it. Please. I like Mary Beth Gaskell.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if this were a modern heist movie, she would be the hacker.
Okay.
She's the person that comes back to you and says, hey, I scouted this out a little bit. Their systems are pretty easily hackable.
Yeah.
This is an easy score. We'd be fucking idiots not to do it. And if you don't do this heist, you're a fucking idiot.
No, I like that. She's a character from Sneakers. She's Possum from Donut County.
Donut County pull.
Oh, absolutely. Well done. Donut County's great. If you didn't play Donut County, you need to play Donut County.
Check it out. It's a really wonderful little indie story.
Yeah, BK is the hero. I'm stealing this from Twitter, but BK is the hero we need and deserve. I like that one a lot. All right, so yeah, and also the fact that, again, articulate. Gentlemen, I think I've got something good. Like, there's colloquialism there.
There is. I kind of feel like there's that potential for bodiness hiding just below the surface.
Yep.
That I always love. Anyone who reads
has a potential, except George Plimpton.
That's a little over my head. I'm sorry. That's above my pay grade mentally.
George Plimpton?
Yeah.
Oh, you know George Plimpton.
I don't know.
He's the Masterpiece Theater guy. He sold in television.
I was never a
Ken Burns baseball?
Guy.
No.
You know what? You like baseball a lot more than I do.
So there's the highbrow. Let's head to the lowbrow.
Uncle.
Your favorite character. There he is right there. What's his quote?
I like Uncle a lot. I don't know if he's my favorite character.
He's in red long johns.
He is in red long johns. He's holding literally the mug that I don't have on me at this exact moment. And a shotgun. Which I feel poorly.
Mug and a shotgun. He already looks ancient.
So here's the thing, though. This quote actually does remind me of a very good friend of mine.
Okay.
And most of my work ethic through high school and college. Don't tell my parents. People call me lazy. I'm not lazy. I just don't like working. There's a difference.
What's that difference, John Ryan?
It's exactly what he says. Laziness is... the inherent inability to be proactive.
Yeah, laziness almost, sort of. Laziness prompts action. It prompts action to avoid work.
Yes.
Laziness prompts innovation. How do I get out of this?
Here's what I'll say about this. This is why it reminds me. So my very best friend from back home, closest thing to a brother that I have on this planet, said this to me a long, long time ago. Laziness... is just a dirty word for efficiency.
Oh, I like that.
Right? Because if you're quote unquote lazy, you will find the shortest distance between two points to complete something.
I am very lazy.
likewise.
Yeah.
Not in the sense that I'm bad at my job or I'm negligent.
Oh, I don't think you're lazy. I think you're very hardworking.
But
I am lazy. I'm legitimately lazy.
You just don't like working.
No.
There's a difference. So anyways, the point is, laziness is you have to actively try to not do work. That's the key.
Okay.
Now, I believe laziness can be a boon if you take it as I do to basically engender efficiency. However, Uncle, I don't think that's the case.
Okay.
People call him lazy. He's not lazy. But he just doesn't like working. And don't get me wrong. Me fucking too. Like, I had my first day off in probably about 6.5, 7 weeks
Yeah.
Last Friday.
Yeah,
and I actively did nothing.
That was me last Wednesday.
It was like, so good. It's great. Yeah. When you've been working for a long, long time and you're just like, you know what? This is enough. I'm going to take a day off and I'm going to choose to do nothing.
I'm just like,
Like, life slows down. I literally sat on the couch for 8.5 hours and played Spider-Man. It was great.
That's a good day.
It was a good day. It was a very good day.
My copy of Spider-Man just arrived yesterday.
Oh,
I still haven't played the Spider-Man.
Enjoy it. You play that Spider-Man. You spider that man.
I'm going to spider that man up.
Do it.
I am.
You Parker that Pete.
I did, however, buy my copy of the original Spider-Man, Bionic Commando, or Top Secret, The Resurrection of Hitler for the Famicom, which I was...
Wait. Stop fucking... Where's the big red button? Stop the presses.
Okay.
No. Are you saying that there is a video game based on the Val Kilmer movie, Top Secret?
No, I wish that I were telling you that.
Well... Why would you phrase it like that?
Because the game is called Top Secret.
Then why is
it
not the Val Kilmer game?
But it's not based on the Val Kilmer movie. Why does it not feature an underwater Western barroom fight?
That is a very good fucking question, Jared.
That sequence is amazing, by the way. There's the best Western sequence ever, right there.
No, it's not. Look, let's be honest. No, it's not.
The underwater bar fight is amazing.
I adore that movie. It is not.
No?
It's not the best Western sequence ever. Come on. No, look, it's all good.
I'm doing
the
magnifying glass.
The point is, if you want to make a top secret Val Kilmer video game, let's figure out a way to secure his license, and I will try and help you make that video game because it is something that I would like to play.
I was speaking of the NES classic based on the not very good Capcom arcade game converted to the mind-blowingly wonderful NES platformer Bionic Commando. Known in the United States as Bionic Commando, it's a tie-in to Commando, an earlier Capcom game, but known in Japan as Top Secret, The Resurrection of Hitler.
I am so fascinated.
Where you play a swingy dude who fights Hitler, and at the end of the game, you blow up Hitler's head with a bazooka. And on the NES, his head explodes, his eyeballs popping out of his head. It's pretty amazing.
I am so fascinated.
He calls you a damn fool.
By the filing cabinet system that is your brain.
No, man. This is even an obscure game. This is a game that most of us have played.
Okay, here's the deal. You go ahead and you email Red Dead Radio. Is that it?
Mail@RedDeadRadio.com.
There it is. Mail@RedDeadRadio.com. I'll never remember that. I'm terribly sorry. If you know of
Bionic Commando or Top Secret, The Resurrection of Hitler.
Is it subtitled that?
Well, it's
Bionic Commando, Top Secret, The Resurrection of Hitler.
No, in America it's called Bionic Commando. In Japan it's Japanese, Top Secret,
The Resurrection of Hitler. I thought you were talking about two different video games.
Well, the American version, they take the Nazi stuff out of the American version, but Hitler's still in it. They just changed his name to Master D, which Jeremy Parrish once described as the evilest rapper ever, but it's still Hitler's face and you still blow his head up. And the Nazis are pink and they don't have Nazi imagery, but they still have eagles and it's real weird. Tilly Jackson.
God damn it, Jared.
Tilly Jackson. Most of us grew up hungry and scared and alone one way or another. That's a very sad statement.
It is.
Most of us grew up hungry and scared and alone, one way or another. It's the one way or another that makes it interesting for me.
I mean, again, this sort of tracks back to what we were talking about with Lenny, where this could be a very on-the-nose portrayal of a character, but I don't believe that it would be.
No, I think when she says most of us, I don't think she's talking about people in general.
But that's what I'm saying. That's what, to me, makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's that notion of... Yes, I may, as this particular character with this particular backstory, have had a very different experience from you, but we all sort of understand the same things.
Do you understand hunger?
Yeah.
Do you understand fear?
Oh, yeah.
Do you understand loneliness?
Very much so. I feel like of those three, Hunger is probably the least experiential one that I
yeah,
have because I've been very fortunate to be in, you know, the middle class of America for the majority of my life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. I've rarely known real hunger.
When it comes to
hunger.
Checking one's privilege.
Yeah. But fear and aloneness, we can understand. Yeah. And hunger remains a problem in America today.
Yeah.
And was perhaps even more so then.
It absolutely was more so then. I mean, it's still despicable, the levels of it that we see now, but this is not, you know, Red Dead Radio, the Democratic Socialist podcast.
No, but I do think I think that transcends politics, the idea that people are hungry.
Here's the problem, though. It doesn't. Today it does not.
Okay, I'm going to go cry.
Yeah, no. We're just going to jump ahead.
Javier Escuela.
Bring me Javier Escuela. Oh,
before we get to bringing you Javier Escuela.
No,
I screwed up
that
segue. Tilly, one of the only characters not holding something.
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, everyone seems to be holding something except for Tilly, and I feel like that's...
I don't know why. Everybody else has got either a hat, a weapon, something. Tilly's not holding anything. I don't know why.
I mean, I feel like if we really want to dig into imagery or symbolism that may not be there, there's the fact that Tilly's strength comes from herself and not a gun.
Well, Tilly's got... the artist's depiction of Tilly is powerful. And I'm not trying to be goofy there. When Tilly looks at you, she looks right at you in this picture.
Yeah.
Some of these folks are posing for photos. Wow, that's really bad.
Posing for photos.
There we go. Some of these folks are posing for photos.
Yeah.
But she's not. Javier Escuela.
Bring me Javier Escuela.
If we have to fight, we fight. If we have to run, we run. If we have to die... Oh, wait, no, I read it wrong. If we have to fight, we fight. If we have to run, we run. If we must die, we'll die. But we'll stay free.
Mm-hmm.
We met Javier for a very, very brief slice of Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah. He was pretty much there, and then he was dead.
We meet him in a storeroom. We throw him in a cell, maybe. And
oh, no.
Oh, no. See, I got him hauled off.
Oh, good for you. I murdered the shit.
You murdered him?
Oh.
Okay. No. You can get him hauled off.
John was not a forgiving man in my playthrough of Red Dead.
Okay.
It was just easier.
Yeah, okay.
With Javier, I mean, I feel like that scene in the storeroom really is very emblematic of who he becomes. But also, we see the seeds of that here with him. This whole notion of we have to fight, we fight. If we have to run, we run. You know, we'll have to die, but we'll be free. It's that concept of doing whatever it takes to see tomorrow. Obviously in Red Dead 1 or Red Dead Redemption 1, he very much tries that to take that tack of pleading with John, of fighting with John, trying to appeal to John's sensitivities.
And he's trying to survive.
Exactly, and that's the key. Where it's not necessarily because he actively just super loves lying to somebody. It's because he knows that there are one of maybe three or four ways that this whole situation can end. And
most of them are not good for Javier.
Exactly. So seeing, you know, sort of where... Again, one of my favorite notions of things that tell us about Red Dead Redemption 2 in Red Dead Redemption 1 is that scene where he says to John, like, oh, come on, man, we're brothers, we're family. And John says, yeah, we're family, until you and Dutch went crazy and then family didn't mean so much no more. And again, I'm really curious to see where that goes, especially because if this is the quote that represents Javier in 1899, not 1912... It's a very curious turn, I feel, that he takes in those 11 years.
What is go crazy? For a group of people that are existing outside of society, for people that have become effectively modern-day merry men of Robin Hood, that are living out on the edge of things, that we know are being pursued across the American West by encroaching forces of law and organization that themselves are motivated by largely corrupt factors. What would be defined as going crazy for somebody who's in the middle of that? That's got to be pretty nuts.
It does. I mean, I feel like John saying went crazy is sort of less about Javier and Dutch really changing than it is John having sort of an epiphany about who he was and who they were and the fact that that relationship could no longer continue in a viable fashion.
It's going to be interesting to see how this game reframes what we think we know about these people.
Yeah, I'm super curious to see it. I'm also super curious to see it how we, as a new third party, watch that from not the sidelines, from the middle of it, but also I feel like Arthur will likely be a relatively neutral party in this group.
Oh, interesting.
You know, we've talked about how you can engage with almost everybody, how you can live this life. I would be surprised if we see Arthur take, not because he's necessarily weak-willed or because he doesn't have opinions of his own, but because he is so conflicted between what he sees happening and the life that he's already known.
Yeah, I'm a little worried about, I mean, John left somehow.
I think John leaves because of Arthur. Yeah, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, that moment at the end of the first trailer when we hear Arthur's voiceover basically say, you know, when the time comes, you got to leave and don't look back because this is done, this is over.
Yeah.
I will 100% bet money that he's talking to John.
Does he stay to the bitter end?
I feel like he has to.
That's rough.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
Karen.
Life is hard.
Karen Jones. Now, first off, the name Karen
Jones.
I love the name Karen, but the name Karen's been ruined for me ever since the Nintendo Switch release. If I hear the word Karen, I see the girl going to the party with the Switch from the Karen ad.
I got nothing on that. For me, I just think about Megan Mullally on Will and Grace.
Oh, there's that.
Which too. Is almost worse because that means that, I mean, I've heard Karen talk and she doesn't sound anything like Megan Mullally.
Not at all.
But at the same time, like, I 100% would think it hilarious if all of a sudden a patch released at day one and she's just like, oh, honey. If that was her for the rest of the game.
Okay, now I've just gone Parks and Rec now.
I know, right?
Okay, wow.
I have and done both of those things.
Yeah, I'm just
talking
seeing
about
her
meat dress wiggling around her butt. Jesus. Megan Mullally, in the off chance that you happen to watch this show, I adore you.
Freaking amazing. Running scams, robbing banks, screwing over the rich and horrible. Rich and horrible.
Yep.
I assume she's equating those that those are the same people, not two groups.
Yes. No. Well, there's no comma there, so they have to be the same.
The rich and horrible.
If Karen were someone to use the Oxford comma now, we would know that she was referring to two different groups.
But I do love the Oxford comma.
I love the Oxford comma.
It's an Oxford comma, buddies.
There's a wonderful comic, if you haven't seen it, about the Oxford comma differentiating between, what is it? Three different people at a party, strippers, Stalin, and Hitler. But when you say it without the Oxford comma, it just becomes two strippers that happen to also be Stalin and Hitler. Have you not seen this?
No.
It's delightful, and I'm sorry that I've ruined the punchline for you.
You're on a different internet than I am.
I'm on a very different internet than you.
Karen Jones, running scams, robbing banks. Okay, so Karen, pistol in hand, robbing banks?
So the fun thing is, in that case, we've actually watched Karen rob a bank.
Right.
Karen,
or you have.
I have, yes. Karen is, well, I mean, you've sort of seen Karen rob a bank in some of the trailers. Pardon me. Karen's functionality in bank robbing, at the very least in what we've seen, she's sort of, we were talking about the A-team earlier, she's sort of the face in that
one.
She is the point person. She'll take stock of what's happening inside, and then she'll choose a path of action depending on what you want and also what the situation may call for. So in the demo that we saw, she chose to either play sort of the lost, in from the wilderness lost girl, or the drunken floozy. Naturally, we kind of went with the floozy because it's always hilarious. And she basically serves as distractions for you as you're robbing banks. But I feel like the quote specifically and what we've seen of her, what we know of her, and the image that is paired with her as well, is that she's all about, she knows what the outlaw life entails, she knows what it means, and she's all about it.
She's in.
Yeah, she's in it to win it. I feel like if we look at other characters like Sadie or, I mean, even like Arthur to a point, who are sort of haggard, they're getting over it very quickly. They just want a normal-ish life, or as normal a life as they can make for themselves. Karen loves it. She's like in the thick of it.
That's the feel you get from her?
Yeah, that's the vibe that I get off of Karen, that she'll always, if the gang were to stop being a gang, she wouldn't know what to do.
Jack Marston. Young, little boy Jack Marston. Also holding something. In this case, he's got a stick. He's got his little suspenders. Jack Marston.
Where's his hoop?
Where's his hoop?
Where's the boy's hoop, damn it?
It might be out of the frame.
I hope it's just like rolling around in the back of these hills.
So there's Jack. He's part of the gang. There it is.
Technically, yes, Jack is part of the gang.
Part of the gang.
Yes.
Did you catch the bad guys? That's his quote. Did you catch the bad guys?
This
I love this so much.
The rest of the gang, and specifically John, Abigail, Arthur, and Dutch, than anybody else, than Jack himself. the notion that, you know, I mean, we know that Dutch recruits members of his gang who are young, who are impressionable young mm-hmm. men, with very often without direction.
And women, it appears.
And women, case. Yes. With Jack, we sort of see someone who's just started here already and is automatically sort of, I don't want to say indoctrinated, but kind of indoctrinated by the sort of legend the gang has created about themselves and around themselves.
If you grew up in an insular community
yep.
that was literally outside the law, moving from place to place, outside of connection with the rest of civilization, you would believe what you were told.
I mean, I feel like that's, again, like potentially some of the best social commentary that we'll see in Red Dead 2 will likely come from the place of how the gang interacts with Jack.
I agree. Yeah. He will be our surrogate in a way.
His reactions will be our contrast point.
I'll put it that way. He will be the fulcrum our reactions he move on.
I feel like he will be there to remind us
yeah.
that what we are seeing happen, what we are choosing to do,
yeah.
are, regardless of how we may justify them,
yeah.
they are still
screwed up,
morally atrocious,
and have consequences. They are affecting yes. this child because there is something wrong with Jack. By the time we see Jack
oh, yeah.
in Red Dead,
something's up with Jack. Something's up with Jack. Jack.
Yeah, something's
sorry,
up with
I'm
Jack.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I feel badly.
All work, no play have made him a dull boy. It's
well,
just,
dull in certain sense of the word.
Yeah. Listen, they had crow problems in that farm. All right, corn. It was rough. Had a hard time. But no, I mean, I
blame those crows for the death of my father. I really wish that was the story at the end of fucking Red Dead 1, where it wasn't that he was angry at Edgar Ross, he was just angry at those fucking birds. That'd be the stupidest game ever.
So we've got...
You killed my paw, birds.
You killed my paw, birds. Now it's your turn.
Birds killed my paw.
How do I keep them from going into the barn? All right, we got to move off here. This is all being edited out.
Oh, come on now. Leave my bird conspiracy theory in. How dare you put down my bird thoughts?
Abigail.
And John.
Abigail and John. Abigail like Roberts.
But I mean, do we know, is she officially Abigail Marston?
I mean,
she was married to John, sure, but like, did we ever get the know. Official, like, yes, she is Mrs. John Marston?
Her quote's TM. Interesting. If they so much as put one bruise on him, I swear I'll bring the fires of hell on them myself. Who's them? Is them the gang? Is them the outside world? Is them Dutch and Javier?
I feel like it's whoever those boys were, what that were holding him hostage in trailer number 2.
You think so?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. Wait, trailer 3? Mm-hmm. Trailer 3. That was the one I was thinking of. Sorry.
Saddlebag over the shoulder, pistol tucked in the belt.
I feel like the imagery plus the quote is what this tells me, just looking at this one still image, is that this woman is ready to bail on this entire endeavor at a moment's notice. And mm-hmm. the only reason she is still there is because of Jack and John.
Yeah.
And not because of Jack, because she could take Jack with him anytime she wants.
She didn't know where else to go, you think?
No, it's because John won't fucking leave.
Ah.
And she loves him so goddamn much, but he is so fucking blind.
You think that's what it is?
Yeah, of course.
You think she sees it before he does?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, that's 40-foot writing on a 30-foot wall for her.
Okay.
That like I feel like the second she met Dutch, she was a little bit taken aback.
So why'd she go with him?
Because there was a life there. Mm. Look, sometimes if you
have we'll do things
three with, options yeah. and they're all fucking terrible,
you take the bad
least,
one that's least
the
bad.
Least terrible of the three options.
That sounds familiar.
Right.
For more on that, read my autobiography.
Oh, buddy.
John Marston.
And
guess about all I got now. Oh, about all I got.
You can do it. I believe
now.
In you.
His doubts.
Doubts and scars. And so sort of following up on that, you know, I feel like that is very much the John that we run into at the end of his time
mm-hmm.
In this gang.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like there's a lot to be said for Rockstar's animation team based on what we saw out of that trailer moment. Where he's on his knees, he's got an arm around his throat, he's got freshly stitched scars. Because It's a rare thing when you can see a character in a video game thinking. And I feel like they did that really well in that moment.
Yeah.
You see Arthur considering his options as Dutch sort of apathetically looks out the window towards what's happening. You see John very seriously wondering how he got to that point.
Yeah.
And I think after that moment happens, because we know he lives, that's where this sort of idea comes from. Because in this image, he's already got his scars. We've seen in trailers him with his scars more fully healed. I mean, realistically thinking about it, it sort of looks like Valentine, that area that we saw in the demo, may be the place in which that altercation takes place.
Seems like it, yeah.
I would be somewhat surprised if that was not fairly early in the game.
Yeah? You think we're going to see that?
I feel like, because there's always, if we didn't, it would be like watching a Batman movie before Bruce Wayne's parents get killed.
Like, that's an excellent comparison.
It starts, like, so Gotham, the TV show Gotham, yeah, for example. You the second you meet young Bruce Wayne in that show, you're like, I know what happens to you.
I know.
And then it's 9 to 10 episodes of what the fuck happens to this kid.
Yeah,
the
best,
like, who cares?
I'm glad you're bringing this up. The best prequels are about recontextualization.
Yep.
The best prequels take something you think you understand and radically alter your understanding of what took place.
Yep.
And they do it in creative and interesting ways. And I think that's what we're going to see in this product. I've thought a lot about that. You watch The Good Place?
I do, actually. Yeah, okay, I like the show a lot.
You've watched the second season then, right?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things, yes, I like about The Good Place is how its second season, despite being a sequel, really is largely built around recontextualizing what you saw in the first.
Yeah. I don't think I've finished that season. I think I've watched probably the first 4 or 5 episodes.
Oh my gosh, it gets so good. The best part of The Good Place is
the
second half of the second season.
We're going to cut right here because potential spoilers for all of you who haven't seen it.
We're back, and John Ryan magically has a sandwich now. He was reluctant because he thought it'd be gross to talk about a sandwich on the show. It's in his mouth right now.
I don't want to just be chewing into a mic like an asshole.
You know, I love when people eat on podcasts. One of my favorite things.
Do you?
I do.
Do you love it?
It's very natural.
Do you love the... Well, of course it's natural, but do you just love the unabashed tone of fucking chewing?
I think...
Chomping on sprouts and turkey and breads.
I mean, who doesn't want some delicious sprouts and turkey and breads?
Look, they're delicious foodstuffs.
I would kill for bread right now. I haven't had bread in so long, I've forgotten what it tastes like.
I know,
but... Are we centered on the frame here? Look at the frame here. Let's see. How are we doing?
We're fine.
All right.
Look, you could stand to scoot in a little bit, to be honest.
Here we are. Scooting in here a little.
Look at you go.
We had to move the camera when I was doing that.
Anyways, you should totally watch The Good Place. Also, NBC, you should totally give us money for plugging your shit.
Absolutely. And you should also talk about Leopold Strauss, who says, it's a nasty world out there, and it's catching up with us. This is my favorite of all the quotes.
Really?
Yes. Okay. I like that. It's a nasty world out there, and it's catching up with us. Leopold Strauss, old, bookish.
Huge fucking nerd.
Yeah, got the glasses on. Not just some, like, hello, I'm some rugged dude out on the frontier. Well-dressed, he's got two things in his hand. He's got a big old book that looks like it might be an accounting book, and he's got a big wad of cash underneath that in his hand. And I love that he's got the big wad of cash. That makes me happy. Who is this guy? Is he the banker? Is he the bookie?
Is he the money man? As weird as it would be for a gang like Dutch's to have a bookkeeper, I could see it.
I don't know. I kind of like the idea.
No, I'm not saying I don't like the idea, but I'm saying, like, I can see it being the case. And I can see him, I mean, fucking look at him. The only thing he's missing is the green visor and the Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 pencil.
Okay, you went Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 pencil there, and I'm very impressed.
Why?
Because the fact that you know what a Dixon Ticonderoga... Now, I can't even say it.
Say it 10 times fast.
You can't say it. Now, I was supposed to say Dicon Radish. I can't say it once.
Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 pencil. Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 pencil. Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 pencil.
That's very impressive.
I've only had 3 beers tonight.
Don't know how you do it. Anyway, I don't know much about young Leopold here or old Leopold.
He's not young. Come on now. That's an old man.
Yeah.
That's an old man. I like the idea of Leopold being the bookkeeper for this because it is, once again, much like Lenny, an indicator that the gang is centered on things being fair for people. Because if you have a bookkeeper, that's to make sure that someone's keeping an accurate tally of what's coming in and what's going out. And you know that the only thing it's going out for would be food or supplies, except for divvying it up among everybody else.
Yeah, I mentioned Howard Pyle before. I grew up reading Robin Hood. I love Robin Hood. I've even written about 2/3 of a really terrible Robin Hood novel that no one will ever see because it was so bad. It's a book that taught me a lot about writing.
How dare you say this when I have food in my mouth?
What? Well, that's how I get
it. I demand to read this novel.
No, you don't. It is. I can. It is.
You send your mail to mail@reddeadradio.com.
No. It is Jerry.
Tell Jared to let me read his book.
It is Jerry Bruckheimer's Robin Hood. It's really bad. Okay.
I love
it's
that.
It's terrible.
I want to see Russell Crowe stab dudes in the face in literature form.
There's an exploding wagon. It's very bad. You don't
What's
need that.
What's bad about exploding wagons? Wait, lots. Is it like a firework explosion?
Because there's an exploding wagon in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. This is a different kind of exploding wagon.
Wait.
It's being charged, though.
Wait. Hang on. Did you write the novelization of Robin Hood, Prince of
Thieves? I wish I had, because that would have been amazing.
Is that as close to what this is as
no,
it could
this
be?
No, this is like if Michael Bay directed Robin Hood, but he was like... he had better taste, it would have come out like this book. This is the first
this
book I ever tried to write.
This is the campaign I want to run.
It's really terrible. But it taught me a lot about writing.
I'm sure.
And
it did.
I went on and finished 2/3 of another book I never tried to do anything
I about. Demand to read all of your books immediately.
Absolutely not. Bill Williamson. Right. Don't try anything stupid, and we won't do anything unkind.
This is fun because Bill Williamson is both stupid and unkind.
I love that you point that out.
I mean, like that's the thing where it's like, Bill is the least self-aware person in the universe of Red Dead Redemption.
And his quote is...
I mean, look, don't try anything stupid and we won't do anything unkind. That is a very good, tough guy in the Old West quote.
Yeah.
At the same time, it is also emblematic of his fucking idiot nature. Mm-hmm. Because he doesn't understand the fact that this is essentially like, by his very existence, is unkind.
Charles Smith, new character.
Charles Smith, new character who we met in the trailers. He offers to teach Arthur how to hunt, if memory serves correctly.
The amount of hell we've raised, we're owed some back, is his quote.
I think that's just a cool fucking line. I think that just sounds awesome.
It sounds reflective. That's somebody who's looking at ideas like consequence,
yes,
guilt.
Very much so. And like, you know, it's a great line. It's super cool. But it does sort of speak to that notion of, okay, we've been on the run. We've done these terrible things. And it's sort of like almost like a precursor to the idea of John talking to Bonnie in Red Dead Redemption 1,
mm-hmm,
where it's, you know, that idea of we were bad people. We killed people we didn't like.
Yeah.
I am not a good man. I am not a hero. There is no redemption for me.
Okay.
Despite the fact that he's actively seeking it. And I think that we'll see a little bit of that with Charles. You know, we know Charles... Charles gave us a good indication that we may see some sort of street fight mechanic as a means of making money.
Yeah.
Unless Charles just happens to randomly get into a bunch of shirtless street fights. I believe it was Charles, anyways, that we saw in a trailer getting into a back alley brawl. Did we break everything?
No, everything's good.
You sure? Did I chew too loudly into the microphone?
You did not chew loudly into the microphone. Please continue.
Sorry. Anyway, I mean, we've seen Charles be someone who is willing to take up with Arthur when he's got work to do, whether or not it may be dangerous or not. We know he has something to do with that train heist the fight, at least on top of a train. I think it's funny that you managed to sort of print them out next to one another. Charles and Micah here. Micah Bell is, if you remember from trailer number 3, there's that really great little single-person sort of exchange where he says, you know, sons of Dutch makes being that, or I guess that makes us brothers.
Yeah.
Sometimes brothers make mistakes. And then here we see Micah's quotation being, I believe there's winners and there's losers and nothing else besides.
Which does he regard himself as?
I mean, I think he tries to regard himself as a winner, but on the inside, he thinks he's a loser.
This picture of Micah Bell is some Wild Bill hiccup stuff.
Yeah, very much. All right,
there's some Wild Bill going on here.
An imposing man with imposing guns and a very imposing mustache.
Yeah, that mustache, those crossed guns, that hair. I mean, he looks rough and frightening. He looks legitimately like somebody you'd be scared to run into.
He does in all of the trailers and the gameplay video that we've seen, too. He offers to raise some hell with Arthur in the gameplay video.
So what is this? Is this a gunfighter whose time has passed? Is it that archetype, this idea that
we
can't make
a
living killing anymore?
About Josiah Trelawney, and sometimes there are just people in the gang who are not good people.
Yeah.
And I think Micah is very much that archetype.
Just a bad dude?
I feel, well, I shouldn't, not necessarily if in terms of Westworld, he's a black hat. He does what he pleases, to whom he pleases, to reach the ends he wants.
I see.
And knowing what we know about some of the other characters, showing back up like Edgar Ross, coming back from Red Dead Redemption 1, I feel like he, I feel like we may see Micah turn tail.
Just break off and run?
No, I mean actively betray the gang.
Oh.
That's my take on Micah.
Interesting.
The moment that they showed us in that trailer, in trailer number 3, plus sort of the notion that they're portraying here with the fact that this is a world of absolutes. You can either win or you can lose, and I'm going to win, goddammit. And that's how it is. By any means necessary.
That's rough.
I do not see Micah as a trustworthy member of the gang.
Okay.
He says that notion of outlaws to the end, I think it's outlaws to the end unless the government makes me a better offer.
Ah.
I do not trust this man as far as I can throw them, and considering that he is made out of pixels and I cannot physically grasp him, I cannot throw him very far.
So an opportunist, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely.
Opportunist. Pearson.
I think he's a smarter version of Bill Williamson.
Oh, I like that.
I think that's the way that I would.
Okay.
Oh, I love that. He is violent and cruel and focused solely on his own gains. That's the sense that I get about Micah Bell.
So now we got Pearson. The people are happy and well fed. I think perhaps we'll be okay.
I think he's found himself here and he just wants to make it.
Got a few things with Pearson here. First off, one name, Pearson.
Yep.
Like Uncle.
Yep.
Pearson. Mm-hmm. I'm Pearson. Now, one of these guys is Reverend such and such.
Yeah. I feel like that's more so, you know, I guarantee, I'll bet Pearson's first name is like Albert or something.
I think Archibald. Cornelius. Cornelius Pearson.
I feel like Cornelius.
Archibald, do you think?
Archibald could be.
Archibald Pearson.
But I feel like, you know, Pearson, like these characters who don't have first names, they definitely have first names.
So Pearson looks like me if I didn't cut my hair and if I shaved my beard but kept my mustache. He's holding, I can't tell if it's a cleaver or a trowel.
It looks to me like a trowel.
So is he
No,
gardening?
Wait, no, it's a cleaver because it's got the hole at the top.
So is he, I assume he's the cook?
Pearson is the cook at your camp, yeah.
Yeah.
In the demo that we saw back in the spring, he basically was the, not quest giver, what I like about this is that there are no real quest givers. It's just sort of people who need things, and you can choose or not choose to help them. Pearson basically said, hey, camp is doing fine, but we will be hungry again if you don't get food by probably tonight or tomorrow. And, yeah, he's what I think is interesting about Pearson is that he is clearly in with this group of people for the long haul.
Yeah.
You know, we saw him in our demo, which I assume probably takes place towards the beginning of the game, because I don't think they would show us that much from the end game.
Okay.
I don't, but at the same time, we then also see him in what I feel to be towards the end of the story, where they've all sort of had to run to the mountains, run to this cabin, where you can see Hosiah and Dutch clearly facing off against the rest of the group with Arthur sort of looking on with that side eye towards the end of the trial number 3. And Hosiah's still, or not Hosiah, Jesus, Pearson's still there.
Yeah.
He's one of the few who made it, mm-hmm. whether or not everyone else has abandoned them or died.
Assuming we're jumping ahead as
assuming,
far as
assuming that we are jumping ahead, that we are not.
Because that's
seeing,
hard. Preview, they're going to be so careful about what they show us.
Oh, but I'm sure. And I'm sure that half of what we've seen in trailers is designed strictly as misdirection to make me think I know everything about a fucking story before it happens. And I truly hope that that's the case, that I'm incredibly surprised by all of this. But Pearson seems to be finding himself with these group of people. And I don't necessarily think it's because he necessarily believes in the cause of the gang, but I think it's more so because he just doesn't have anywhere else to go.
Okay. Susan Grimshaw. I swear half of you would just rot in your own filth if nobody kept you in check. Susan, nothing in hands, mm-hmm. arms crossed.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like a woman of maybe middle age.
I would guess probably mid to late 40s.
Got a scowl going on. Big old hair.
She's momming it. She's
kind of momming it here, and that statement is kind of a momming it statement.
Exactly. That's what makes me say it. I feel like Susan Grimshaw I feel like Susan is the kind of character who, while she may not necessarily make big decisions for the gang, she sort of informs how the rest of them should live. Like, if you, I feel like of all these people, aside from maybe Dutch, the worst person for your own sake you could cross is Susan. Not because she'll tan your hide or anything like that, but because, I mean, have you ever disappointed your mom? Like, I mean, like, not...
So you really are leaning into the maternal on this.
I think so. Yeah, I think she's very much like a caretaker, an organizer, who is clearly fucking fed up of not necessarily cleaning after these people, but I'm not sure.
I like that thesis. Again, trying to construct a person's personality from one photo and one sentence.
It's fun challenge.
We're chasing fortune cookies here to a point.
I'm very much a dog chasing cars right now.
But I really enjoy it. Look at that sandwich. You eating that sandwich up?
Cool.
I really should have just let you eat this before the show, but it's so much more fun to watch you have to eat it as we get there. I am a monster. I speculate and wonder how much depth... this is a character that of all these folks I want to know more about. This is the one that the quote reveals the least to me.
Really?
Yeah. It tells me something maternal. That's where I lean. But when she talks about nobody keeping you in check, what does that mean? How can she do that? How does she keep them in check? Because I think there's got to be more. For a group of people this strong spirited, more than bad.
Grabbing somebody by the ear and dragging them through camp. 100%.
I think it might go deeper than that.
Look,
for people like this.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah, and that's what I'm wondering about. Molly O'Shea.
I don't think is that Irish.
You're playing a dangerous game.
See, this is the one that's the most cryptic to me.
Okay, so when I read dangerous game, my mind goes gambler instantly. Like, that's where my head went. Like, if the archetype of the female gambler, have you ever watched have you ever watched Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster in Gunfight at the OK Corral?
No.
Okay, so, the archetype of the upper crust female Western gambler. A woman making her way in quote unquote a man's world, a misogynistic universe where women are largely pushed away from many vocations. Yep. Somebody that's made their way anyway. That character is kind of an archetype in a couple of prominent Westerns. And I wonder if Molly's following that.
In Maverick?
Jodie Foster.
There it is.
Yeah.
I wanted to say Sally Fields. And I was like, nope, that's not her.
And I like that character archetype very much. Yeah. I enjoy that character in Westerns and in other places as well. And I like the idea of Molly in that, but I'm locking on to game and onto the attire, which is rather upper crust. She's holding a fan.
Right. So, I mean, she might be the sort of upper crust guy you're talking about. You know, again, while I love the idea that we're sort of pulling from just the images, just what they're showing here based on the character model and based on the quote.
We're not outside of context completely here. I mean,
we know that Molly is, I don't really know what to call it.
Jesse's girl?
She's Dutch's paramour. And she's, I think, both in the expression that she has in her face and also in the quotation of you're playing a dangerous game, she's sort of over it.
Oh, Molly's going to die. Your Dutch's girlfriend, Molly's dead.
You think she's toast? She's not going to bail?
Toast.
I think she's going to bail. I don't think she'll see the proverbial gallows.
I think we are lucky if two of these people get away. I think this is a grapes of wrath situation.
Well, I mean, we know at least three of them get away.
Yeah, but what I mean is, like, outside of the ones we know about. Like, I think this is one of those, like, everybody going to die horribly in different ways. Either picking one another off Hateful Eight style or being picked off by the authorities or dying at the hands of a savage West that simply killed people just because they went outside and forgot to shake their boots out because there was a scorpion in them. And yeah, I think I feel... Molly's dead.
I feel like some of them will definitely see that fate. I feel like potentially Molly... if we had to take bets right now on characters we think will live versus characters we think will die.
Yeah.
I'm going to bet that, let's just say who lives. I think Molly might live. She's a might for me, 50-50
shot. Wait, are you going to go through all of these?
No, just real quick. I'm going to say Molly lives, 50-50 shot. Susan walks away.
Wait.
Micah Trent.
No, we need, you know what? We're going to stop right. We need to make a board. we're gonna do this.
We're doing brackets.
We're gonna do brackets. All right. All right. We're gonna go back to this and do brackets.
I think Tilly lives.
Because I want to go home at some point tonight.
I think Swanson dies.
Look at this madman next to me.
Anyways, no, sorry. Okay, so there you go. Those are my predictions.
We're gonna make brackets.
Anyways, Molly, I think, will see the end of life. Not with Dutch's gang.
Molly dies horribly.
All right, that's fine. I think you're definitely right in the sense of people will probably die, and one of those people is Hosiah.
Oh, you think Hosiah's dead?
I think Hosiah's fucking toast.
Hosiah Matthews, who wish he'd acquired wisdom at less of a price?
Well, so here's... Again, I feel like this quote is exceptionally fitting for the notion of Hosiah that I have in my own head.
Expound.
So Hosiah, we know, is quote-unquote Dutch's best friend. Oh. Which, let's be real. Hosiah thinks Dutch is his best friend.
Yeah.
There is no chance in hell that this doddering old man is actually Dutch's best friend and most trusted confidant.
Do you think Dutch has friends?
No, of course not. Yeah. He uses people. He has pawns. He does not have friends. I think he does have people that there is trust there, but I don't think it's anything more than perfunctory. Yeah. Hosiah will 100% die because of this fucking quote. The greatest lesson that he has to learn is that sometimes people who you think were doing you favors will absolutely fuck you over. Which is a hard lesson to learn, to be fair. But I think based on everything that we've seen, because every time we've seen Hosiah in trailers, almost, he's been expounding on the glory days of him and Dutch as young men. How they met. They were two grifters who tried to rob each other. What a fun romantic story. What a hilarious way for them.
This is a man who gets betrayed and disillusioned at the very end.
No, this is a man who gets betrayed and betrayed and betrayed and betrayed and betrayed and keeps going back because he believes that someone is truer than they actually are. Likewise, same fucking here. It comes down to that scene in the cabin in the third trailer.
Yeah.
You've got Arthur off to the side, kind of looking at them. Clearly, some kind of conversation is happening. I assume it's a, we've been on the run, we're starving, what the fuck are we going to do kind of conversation. And Dutch and Hosiah are both, well, Dutch is of the camp of, y'all just, you know, stick with me, I'll get you through this. He won't. He has no intention of helping any of these people except for himself. But Hosiah's right there next to him, pointing a gun at folks, or holding a lantern, I guess, I think. I don't really recall what the exact image is off the very top of my head. But Hosiah's there next to Dutch. And even Arthur at this point, even Arthur looks at Dutch, a man who has raised him since he was a fucking child, being like, dude, what the fuck are you thinking right now? What the hell is going on? But Hosiah is still fucking there with blind commitment to this guy. And you know, within 30 seconds of that scene starting... There could be a gun on the back of his head pulling the trigger.
Is this like a Jack Nicholson Bob gun situation for Batman?
Absolutely. Yeah. I 100% feel that Hosiah is going to meet his end back or the front by Dutch as an easy ploy to escape the law.
Let's talk about Dutch. Dutch Vanderlinder,
last on the list.
They're chasing us hard because we represent everything that they fear. That's the quote.
What a grandiose fucking sentiment.
Yeah, they're chasing us hard because we represent everything that they fear. He's holding a knife. He's the only one that's holding a weapon of that intimacy, savagery.
Both.
Yeah. Knife wounds are nasty, nasty things. But they're chasing us hard. That's the world, I assume. That's everybody that's not them, right?
I think specifically in this case, they're referring to the law. I think you bring up an interesting point with the knife being a more intimate or brutal weapon. You can shoot folks in the back, but it's a lot worse when you stab somebody in the back. And I feel like that's what we're going to see a lot of from Dutch.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying Dutch is literally going to stab versus shoot. I'm saying making an expression about his character.
Pieces.
Oh, shoots John in the binocular face. I mean,
exactly. I don't think he has an aversion to guns. I think it's more symbolic than
the character art. Says something about the character.
The knife has long since been a symbolic weapon of betrayal.
Yeah. Et tu, Brute.
If you look at confrontational weapons, they're swords, they're staffs, they're bows. They're never knives or daggers.
Yep.
Daggers are always reserved for close, personal, intimate.
Yeah.
And from behind. The friends of Caesar.
Exactly. That's what I said. Et tu, Brute. Exactly. Jan Cassis has a mean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous.
God damn, you did what now? Read your Shakespeare.
I do love my Julius Caesar.
So they're chasing us hard because we present everything that they fear. I feel like Dutch is... There are a few folks in this motley crew that I think we could classify as the archetypal charlatan. But none so much as Dutch.
Yeah. And the in denial charlatan, like the non self aware charlatan.
See, this quote to me is very much self aware.
Does he knows that he's full of it?
So again, the goes crazy notion to me is less about actually going insane and more so about panic, because when you panic, you don't fully think things through. And Dutch, that we know of. The sense that I get from Dutch is that he is nothing if not a meticulous planner and a conniving individual. He always has plans. He always knows just what to say. He is charismatic in the sense that he can get people to follow him because he is careful in his organization to make sure that they have regimented success.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even if they fail 2 out of 5 times, that's still 3 successes, which means they're beating the odds, which means they're on top. And in this case, you know, they're chasing us hard because we represent everything that they fear. That to me rings as a quote where it's not reassurance. It's not necessarily desperate, but it is a statement that is made to someone whose faith is wavering.
I'm really intrigued by this aspect of the Mad King and the renegade subculture. Do you know much about the Kingdom of Jones?
Like Indiana?
No, Mississippi. No.
Clearly I do not.
Okay, well, during the American Civil War, there was a county in Mississippi that rebelled against the Confederacy.
Great way to go. Wait, should I be saying great way to go, guys?
It's an interesting story.
Are they doing it for the right reasons?
You got to dig deep on that one. But at least
way to go, guys.
Yeah. But a lot of it is that effectively a rebellious subculture in the midst of an organized corruption. Okay. And whether or not that itself was a moral imperative that took place within that community is a very interesting question that's worth exploring in some depth.
Interesting.
I'm really interested. The fact even they have tried and tried and tried to get through my head in this marketing that this gang is a community. That's a thriving thing. That's your family. But the fact that they've given me a vast ensemble cast of people to care about in different ways, all of whom, from an image and a quote, I'm able to ascertain or speculate on certain details. All of whom I'm going to spend an extensive amount of open world time with.
Mm-hmm.
And most of whom I think I'm going to lose.
Oh, yes, hands down. I mean, we see it in that third trailer. Like, it goes from a big group of people in that one wide shot towards the beginning to a very small few in that cabin.
Oh, I mean, by the time we're at Red Dead Redemption, we got...
Oh, it's maybe 3 of
Dutch, them. Javier, Bill, and then we know about Abigail,
Dutch, Javier, Bill,
John,
and Jack. The 6 people.
Yeah.
Out of 25.
Everybody else we...
Oh, and Uncle.
Yeah, and Uncle.
7.
So the rest of these folks, who knows? Maybe their fates are kinder. I think there's going to be a lot of tragedy in this game. I do. I'm going to stick with. I think Arthur survives.
I hope so. I would very much hope so.
I don't think they pulled the same trick twice.
Concern, or not concern, but like the one thing that I hope not to see is tragedy for tragedy's sake. I feel like all too often we see in video games, especially, but also movies and TV, and sometimes books. A supporting character get killed off to give a semblance of emotional...
See, Game of Thrones.
Great example. In video games, Carmine from Gears of War.
Exactly.
Now, obviously, like in 3 and 4, that became a running gag.
Yeah.
But like in 1 and 2, they wanted you to feel for Carmine. And then they would just be like, nah, fuck it, Carmine's dead now.
I think, I could be wrong. But I think that while there'll be a lot of death in the story, it'll be death that makes contextual sense when you've got this group of
and
people running.
And that's what it is for me, is the big difference between what this could be and you know what I don't want to see.
No, I bring this up every month on any podcast. Mind you, watch Steven Universe?
I've just started, actually.
So Steven,
I'm like 2 episodes.
Steven Universe has what makes that show amazing. It's at like 150 episodes in. They've killed one character. in 150 episodes.
That meant something, didn't it?
It did, but beyond that death, which really did mean something, they have taught me that there are way worse things you can do to characters you love than kill them.
Oh, of course.
And that's what I suspect. Rockstar has already killed the man we loved. And yes, there will be more death, but I think they know better ways to torture us than just killing someone.
Oh, I don't disagree with that. I think they're very adept.
There are much worse ways to hurt you than kill somebody.
For sure. But the good news is we don't have to wait too long to find them.
No, look at this. And we got through them. And hey, it's only been like 2 hours. So,
oh my God, really? Is that it?
I mean, that's because we hung out and talked before the show. We did have a
hand. Hey, am I still reigning poker champion?
Yeah, you're still the reigning poker champion. Exactly. Look at this guy right here. Reigning poker champion.
And humble to beat.
Yeah, and humble to be. Ladies and gentlemen,
most humble.
God knows why you're still watching or listening, but you are. You can reach us at mail@reddeadradio.com. That's mail@reddeadradio.com.
Petition to let me read Jared's books.
Petition to let him not read any of my
unfinished. Read your books.
There are three long unfinished manuscripts. Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me? There's a trilogy?
Okay, so no, they're not a trilogy. They're completely unrelated.
Oh, no. They're 100%
One is a Robin Hood novel.
Love it. Super into it.
Second one is a horror novel.
Robin Hood horror. I love it.
Third one is a children's fantasy novel. So none of which are done.
I have to read them.
I tend to lean in that.
I'm starting a book club about this.
None of them are done. But each one's better than the last.
Great. Awesome. I can't wait to read all of them.
None of them are done. None of them are finished. Okay. Oh, sure. Well, you're just going to be like, who are these people?
Anyways, I got nothing after anyways. That was something you took over.
Red Dead Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. See you next week. We're almost there. Bye.